listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. The promises of technology and crime fighting have played out in the movies for more than a decade. The Minority Report from 2002 stands out as prescient because data analytics were used to predict crimes and stop them before they happen. The promise and peril of technology-driven crime fighting is the subject of John Fassman's latest article for The Economist, Data Detectives. In it, he looks at how law enforcement is using these new tools. He's joined on the show today by Faiza Patel, co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. Both, welcome to Midday.
Thank you.
Thanks.
John, let me start with you. The Minority Report was loosely based on a novel by Philip K. Dick and directed by Steven Spielberg. And in it, there is a unit called pre-crime, which apprehends criminals based on pre-knowledge before they've committed a crime. How close is law enforcement to having units like this?
Well, the pre-crime, it was extremely difficult to avoid using the Minority Report analogy in my piece, but it isn't exactly right. There are predictive policing technologies or programs that departments, I think around 63 departments, use. And what these do is they use data about crimes that have been committed to try to predict crimes that will be committed. Their accuracy is still a subject of some debate. They appear to be pretty good at forecasting property crimes like burglary and car theft and robbery, less good at predicting things like murder, and it's still unclear if they work over the long term. But what they really do is they give police chiefs a way to answer the question they will get from every mayor, which is, what are you doing about crime? And the answer is, well, we've got this great new tech that's going to predict crime, it's going to solve everything. But whether it actually works is not terribly clear.
So most TV police shows have followed this similar pattern, but according to your research, it's an outdated pattern of crime being committed and then someone calls the police. I mean, that's what we've seen on television for generations now. What is outdated about this formula?
Well, that formula is not exclusively outdated, but these predictive policing programs let police be a lot more proactive. So I was lucky enough to spend a day with the LAPD's patrol unit. What happens is at the beginning of every shift, their program shows them boxes, 500 square foot, boxes of 500 by 500 feet, of places where the places that are predicted of being at risk of crime on this particular day. So police are dispatched to that area. They are told that between responding to calls, we want you driving around that area. The idea is that they will sort of forestall crime by their presence, and that will avert both the victim of crime and will avert having to arrest someone. So police patrol deployment is increasingly determined by these algorithms.
Now, you actually titled one paragraph, "It's Not Cagney and Lacey," and you describe just how much searchable information people generate now. How's that information used to identify future criminals?
Well, that's one of the things that I think society has not yet really come to grips with. The fact is, we just generate in our daily lives, as more of our lives become digital, we just generate more data than we ever have before. And it is really effortless for police to track and store that data. So if you think, 20 years ago, had I done something that caused me to be suspected of a crime and police wanted to know where I went and who I talked to, they would have had to assign a rotating crew of police officers to follow me, to stake me out, and they would have had to convince a judge to give them a pen register for my telephone to let them track who I called and when. Now they can do both of those things passively through automatic license plate readers, which track where I go, and by using sort of fake cell phone towers that can capture who I talk to and when. And so the real change is the amount of data that can be stored, the effortlessness with which police can store it, and the ease with which they can use that data to build a complete portrait of people's lives going back 6 months to a year. And so there really are no policies no national policies that say how long police can store this information, who can use it, to what purpose. So policy has yet to catch up with the massive increase in data we have started to throw off.
And speaking of data, what information can be gleaned about us based on the apps that we download? Because they reveal a lot about who we are.
I think we have to sort of come to grips with how much of our lives can be revealed, not just through the apps we download, but by the mere act of carrying our cell phone around in our pocket and using it the way we do. as we walk around with our cell phone on, it's broadcasting our location to cell phone towers. So it tracks where we go. As we make calls and text, it tracks who we talk to and when, so it tracks who our friends are. And to the extent that we surf the web and buy things on our phone, it tracks our reading habits, our shopping habits, our political preferences. So it really is an intimate portrait of our life that we carry everywhere and that can be tracked easily everywhere.
And before I bring Faiza Patel into the conversation, to your point about our phones tracking our every move. My husband discovered, just tried to look at something through Google, found that Google has this thing that can show you where you've been during the day, this very colorful map tracing your route everywhere around town. He said he was going to disable it, but he loves showing it to people to horrify them.
Yeah.
That one more question for you, John. In terms of police and our phones, can the police listen in on our phone calls without a warrant?
They should not be able to do that without a warrant. And one thing that we need to do is make sure that on our cell phones, our encryption standards are up to the highest possible level they can be. Now, I had a very funny conversation with a veteran European intelligence analyst who said that, when he got into the business, if he saw encryption on someone's phone or computer, then he knew that they were up to no good because there was no reason to install it. Now, of course, the modern economy runs on encryption, and we need to make sure that our personal data is as well protected as possible.
And one more, and then I promise, Faiza, I'll bring you in because the next question I'm going to ask you is pertinent. Our modern world, does the Fourth Amendment protect us? The right against unlawful search and seizure, does that protect us in this modern world that we're in?
That is a fantastic question, and I think it is the central question, the central Fourth Amendment question, certainly, that courts are going to be dealing with for the next generation. The fact is, privacy laws around the world were written for the, postal mail, landline phone, personal filing cabinet era. And so we really haven't come to grips in any deep or systematic way with how to reconcile those privacy expectations with the reality of our digital lives. The Fourth Amendment has been found to protect certain things as the questions have come up before the court. But I can't stress this enough. As citizens, we should not wait for the courts to protect us. We need to be pressing the police to be open and transparent about what they're using, to what purposes, how long they're storing data, and what tech they want to buy. So while we should expect the courts, we should hope that the courts take they strongly protect the Fourth Amendment and update it. It's really up to us as first responders and as citizens whose data is at risk. It's up to us to press the police for transparency and vigilance.
Faiza Patel is the co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program, and she has been nodding on your last point, John, vigorously. Faiza, jump into the conversation. Why were you nodding, I'm assuming, in agreement with John?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think, the points you brought up were really excellent. We've certainly seen the courts struggling with how to apply privacy protections in the digital age. We've had two big Supreme Court cases come out, which have come out really positively and privacy protective. And there's a third one that's expected to come down any day, which is the Carpenter case, which will look at, what process is needed in order to get your cell site location data, what we were just talking about, because your cell phone is in fact simply a location tracking device. So that's a very important case, which we're looking to come out probably next week or the week after as the court winds up its term. But to the broader point, I think that it's really important for municipalities and municipal governments like the New York City Council, for example, to actually, exercise their oversight functions over police departments. And what we've seen happening in a few jurisdictions, particularly out west, is that city councils have passed bills that require police departments to be transparent about what surveillance technology they're using, which would include, predictive algorithms, to tell the council about, what is the process required? Like, what do you need to use a stingray? Like, what level of suspicion is required before you start using an X-ray van? And finally, what are your protections? So one of the things In normal Fourth Amendment law, we're very focused on the front end process. Do you need a warrant? Do you need a subpoena? Or do you need nothing, right? When you're talking about digital communications, it's equally important to have a lot, very strong back end protections. What do you do with the data? How is it secured? Mm. Who has access to it? Who do you share it with? When do you share it with ICE? When do you share it with the FBI? These are all critical questions which should be answered in local legislation that governs police departments. And in New York City, for example, the POST Act, which was introduced in the last city council session, would have done just that. It would have required transparency and accountability about surveillance technologies. And it would have also been really important to think about one issue which we haven't touched on, which is how do these technologies play into traditional policing biases, which tend to be really focused on communities of color.
Oh, so zero in on that. What do you mean?
So one of the things that we just talked about is basically police identifying locations where they're going to go and police. And that's called predictive policing. It's basically a souped up version of CompStat, right? Which the NYPD has used for decades. And the idea there is that you bring all kinds of data into this algorithm, which will then tell you where crime is likely to be committed. So we're not talking about who is likely to commit crime, but we're talking about the location of crime. And the kinds of data that go into this are, we don't know, first of all, because most of these algorithms are black boxes. But based on what we do know, a lot of the data that goes into these algorithms is likely to be racially biased. So for example, arrest records, right? Things like that, which will then reinforce the racial bias that you have that started out, right? So if you have police going back to the same places again and again, they're going to arrest more people because they just happen to be there. So your next round of arrest records are going to show that area as being a high crime area. Then you're going to send more cops back over there. So this is a kind of self-perpetuating cycle that we really worry about.
Is that what the way you're describing it reminds me, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that what they're doing in Chicago?
Well, they're doing a bunch of different things in Chicago. Okay. In Chicago, they also had what's called a heat list where they are...
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Explain it since I brought it up.
Okay. So basically, there they were trying to identify individuals who they thought were likely to commit crimes. And then they were sort of going to those individuals and saying, hey, we've got eyes on you, so you better be careful. And I think it was a little bit more than that. I'm probably oversimplifying
We did an interview with someone about that, and that's almost exactly what it is.
And my understanding is that the studies that have been done on the Chicago program have not demonstrated any effectiveness. And I think this was a point that was brought up earlier as well, which is that, you know, you have all these companies out there. They're selling all these fancy tech toys. And they're like, oh, this is really going to solve all your problems with policing. And I think we need to be very skeptical when we look at these claims. And I think particularly oversight bodies such as city councils should insist that police departments actually demonstrate that technologies that they're deploying are effective in what they're trying to do.
When I was going to ask this question, but we need to take a break first because I'm fascinated by predictive algorithms and to your point about transparency, FISA. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with John Fassman, The Economist's Washington correspondent, and FISA Patel, co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program, on the promise and peril of technologically driven changes in the justice system. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with John Fassman of The Economist and FISA Patel, co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. We are talking about John's article for The Economist, Data Detectives, and how technology is being used in the criminal justice system or in policing. And one of the things, John, that FISA brought up before we went to a break was sort of transparency in police departments and these predictive algorithms. And I keep coming back to this. Maybe listeners remember me bringing this up at least a couple of times about a conversation I had with the president of the Knight Foundation, who made this point of saying, even algorithms have parents. So if police departments are relying on predictive algorithms, who's writing the algorithms?
I think that is an essential point, and I'm very, very glad FISA brought it up. All an algorithm is a set of steps designed to reach a conclusion. And if we feed the algorithms data infected with bias, we're going to get biased results. And this is not a sort of academic concern. We have found that in algorithms used, this is a court case in Wisconsin, that algorithms used in sentencing are not transparent. People can be sentenced for longer for the same crime than someone else because of a decision an algorithm has made. We have found ProPublica did a terrific investigation in Broward County that found that these algorithms tended to sentence African American defendants to longer periods than white defendants because they were perceived to be at higher risk. And so if in your predictive algorithm you use, for instance, arrest data, that will almost certainly produce a biased algorithm because arrest rates are higher in non-white communities because those communities tend to be over-policed, so you tend to have greater contact between residents and police than in white communities. So we need to be very careful about what information the algorithms used. And for that reason, again, I will come back to the question of transparency. It's not enough to say these algorithms are trade secrets and we can't reveal what's in them. They affect people's lives, and people who are being targeted by these algorithms have a right to know what's in them.
I'm going to throw this question out to both of you, but FISA, you might be able to more aptly answer this question from a listener. And a listener wonders how the militarization of police departments play into the concerns we're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the big predictive policing programs was actually developed in Iraq. So a lot of times what you will see is that, you know, technologies that are developed in war zones come home. I mean, that's a very typical thing. And I'm not an anti-technology person. I mean, certainly the police should be able to use technologies that help them carry out their public safety mission. On the other hand, we, the public, need to know what those technologies are, and we need to know what safeguards are in place to prevent abuse of those technologies. So I think militarization is definitely caught up in this. The other piece that's really caught up in this is federal funding, right? You have federal counterterrorism dollars, which flow to police departments. A lot of times they are allocated to purchasing these kinds of technologies. I mean, that's what happened with the NYPD, for example, when they developed their domain awareness system. It was funded primarily from federal funds. So these kinds of financial incentives also play into what's happening in police departments.
And John, in terms of your reporting, do you have any insight into that observation from the caller, the listener?
Well, I think militarization really, it brings up the question of mindset, that as FISA said, a lot of these predictive algorithms got their start in war and are used to sort of predict the movements of an enemy. And I think that we really need to think about how police can improve their relationships with the communities that they serve, particularly communities of color. The LAPD got a new chief yesterday, I think, and he explicitly said that one of his main goals is improving relations between the LAPD and the communities they serve. That's hard to do when you have this military mindset that sees the people you're trying to protect as an enemy.
Now, John, one of the things that separates the United States from the European Union is on this question of privacy and data privacy. And the European Union is far ahead of us when it comes to protecting the privacy of the metadata most of us generate. What steps have they taken?
The GDPR, you have a right to be forgotten, and you have a right, companies, broadly speaking, companies have to tell you how they are using your data and give you the option to opt out. So they have sort of, the fundamental thing that did is it biased the system toward privacy protection, and that's the sort of thing we need to do, broadly speaking, here, that the bias now is not in that direction. You certainly have a way, if you are a very sort of concerned individual, you can take steps to improve, you know, privacy protections online, but the system is not set up to do that, so we need to focus on how we can bias the system toward making sure people's data is saved. And the truth is, I think that most people agree that there should be spaces to disobey, or spaces set up where you have an expectation of privacy in your digital lives online, and it's really hard in a statutory way to carve out where those are right now.
Mm-hmm. How long are U.S. firms allowed to retain data?
I am not sure if there is a sort of broad rule that sets limits on how long firms can retain data or how long police can retain data. As far as police departments go, use policies vary sort of department by department.
Pfizer, you...
Yeah, I mean, so the U.S. Privacy protections are only for certain types of information. So you have HIPAA, for example,
right,
which provides protection, some protections for health information. Your financial information may have some protections. We don't have any overall privacy framework the way that the Europeans do. And when it comes to police departments, there's no uniformity at all. John's assuming they all have use policies, which I kind of doubt, actually. It's not at all clear that police departments have in place, you know, actually regularized schedules for deleting information and the like. And on this sort of European versus US thing, the one thing I would add is that, you know, you have to think about commercial surveillance, right, which is, you know, what Facebook might do to you or Google might do to you. And you have to think about state surveillance. And the two things are linked, right, because a lot of times state surveillance will take advantage of commercial surveillance, right? So for example, social media monitoring programs, et cetera. On the other hand, state surveillance is a kind of a different thing in and of itself. And I think in that sense, I'm not sure that Europe is so much ahead of the United States in terms of protecting the privacy of people vis-a-vis police and intelligence agencies, because the conception of the state over there has always been much more benevolent than in the United States. And I think that the protections are quite limited. And I think it's hard to compare apples and oranges, but I wouldn't say that they're necessarily better than the U.S. in that particular respect.
You know, given all this technology, Pfizer, I'm wondering how this has all reshaped the NYPD's workforce, because basic police work no longer needs to take place by walking the beat or staking out a criminal.
Well, I mean, I think there's two things going on over here. One thing is, as John mentioned earlier, which is the cost of surveillance for police departments has plummeted, right? You know, they don't have to spend resources to surveil people because they can do a lot of it online. And what that means is that sort of structural barriers to surveillance have fallen, right? So previously, you could, you know, pretty much count on the fact that most of the time they had a really good reason for surveilling somebody. You may not like that reason, but they would have thought it through. Now they can kind of do it on the fly. So I think that's one big difference. On the other hand, I think you still see a fair amount of emphasis amongst police departments on beat cops and community policing and the like. I mean, whether they're effective or not is a different thing. So you have these two kind of, one very high-tech and one sort of normal, standard, low-tech strategies being employed at the same time.
Mm-hmm. You know, John, you argue, I think this is on Pfizer's point here, you argue one of the effects technology has on law enforcement is to render its actions less visible. You would notice if a policeman took photos of every parked car and pedestrian on your street, but ANPRs, automatic number plate recognition, and body-worn cameras, body cams, let officers do that as an unnoticed matter of course. That makes speaking up about privacy concerns more important, not less.
Yeah, I think that is absolutely true, that we don't, that surveillance used to carry a much greater cost, both in terms of manpower and financially, for police departments than it does now. I think that a corollary to that is that there is a lot more incidental surveillance. That is, if the police, say, deploy a Stingray, a fake cell phone tower, to catch a certain suspect, that tower will hoover up data from everyone else in that same region. And the same is true of automatic number plates readers, the automatic number plates readers, that they take in data that is not targeted, just sort of as a matter of course. Georgetown Law Center released this terrifying paper that found that over half of all Americans have their faces in an FBI accessible database. Now, that happened because of, you know, passports, because of driver's licenses, for a number of reasons that are innocent and that are part of our daily life. But the fact is, once we are in that system, it's very hard for us to get out of it.
Mm-hmm. You know, we have a caller, Corey from Manhattan, who has something to say about algorithms and programming. Corey, thanks for calling.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I'm a great fan of the program. My daughter and I always listen to it on our way home from preschool. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So one question or one point that was mentioned was that these predictive algorithms that the police departments are using, that they should disclose, the creators of them should disclose the way that they're coded and be transparent about the data and the parameters that they're used. I'm somewhat familiar with the use of predictive algorithms more for expropriation risk and political design. You know, many times these algorithms are machine learning driven. They're deep learning generated. So the programmer, the creator of the algorithm, knows the parameters that were initially put into creating the program. But actually, the programmer has no idea how the program works. In a very real sense, they just don't know. So even if they were compelled under a law to disclose, you know, how it worked, I mean, they actually wouldn't know. They just know that they started with a certain set of data, and the program got very good at, you know, matching the patterns in a way that is success is defined in the program. How would you deal with that problem? How would you design regulations to deal with the fact that forcing the creator to disclose the method, the creator may not know?
That's a Corey, thank you very much for calling and for that question. A bit of a conundrum here. Faiza, John?
I think that makes transparency all the more important. We want to hear the creators of these programs say, you are being policed and we don't know how it's happening. I mean, that would be essential.
Right. It's like like getting them on the record to say they don't know.
Yeah, fundamentally, our justice system, one of the founding principles of our justice system is that it is better for an innocent person to go free than a guilty person to be caught. That is, we would like our system to be biased toward keeping us safe. And to have someone say on the record to the public, we have no idea how the police, how these programs are learning their information, that's really important.
Mm-hmm. Faiza.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. I would also say there's a lot of transparency to be achieved around training data and the kind of information that goes into the program. I think you can also do back-end audits to look at the kinds of results that the program is generating, and that's going to give you some idea as to, you know, whether or not it is biased and is perpetuating biases. But I think I think auditing algorithms is a very challenging thing to do. Nonetheless, we have to come to grips with it, or else we shouldn't be using them. We shouldn't be using mechanisms that we don't understand and we can't explain.
John, let me ask you about street-level surveillance. In your first story in the piece, it goes back to August 25th, 2017, involves a man named Johnny Rush, who was walking home after a 13-hour shift washing dishes at Cracker Barrel, a restaurant in Nashville, North Carolina. What happened when the police watched Mr. Rush cross the street without using a zebra crossing?
Well, these were some really sickening videos. So the police watched Mr. Rush cross the street, jaywalk. He did it a couple of times. The police pulled him over and sort of hassled him about his jaywalking. He was exhausted, as you say. He had just worked 13 hours, and as he started to leave, he started to run away. The police gave him chase, and then body cams caught the police just administering a horrific beating and then tasing him when he was already handcuffed on the ground. Now, this is, I would argue, this is a sort of secondary triumph for body cams. What body cams are supposed to do is deter bad behavior, not catch it. But at least they did catch it in this case, and the officers who administered that beating were dealt with. I think one resigned from the force, and another was, the officer he was training was reassigned. And so body cams are now, the evidence is ambiguous about whether they deter bad behavior, but they certainly catch more of it than they had before.
Well, I was about to ask, have there been any studies that conclude whether body cams actually improve the behavior of police?
There have been some conflicting studies. There have been studies that show that they reduce complaints of force against the police, but there are other studies. There was one that showed that turning on a body cam while an encounter was going on was associated with an increased use of force. So the studies are pretty ambiguous.
Mm-hmm. So, Faiza, do NYPD officers wear body cams?
I believe there's a pilot going on right now. I don't think that all of them do. My last recollection was that they have, several of them do. I think body cams are a really complicated subject, right? Because not only do you have these questions about whether they're effective in deterring bad behavior, as John mentioned, but you also have huge privacy concerns with body cams, right? So what do you do with all this body cam footage that is now in the hands of the NYPD, assuming, or whichever police department is utilizing them? You know, when can the police look at it? Can a cop look at the body cam footage in a use of force complaint before he has to write his statement? Can you go back and take a look at what he did and tailor his statement to what actually happened?
That's a good question, because we have seen many times where there's a use of force thing that happens. The police gives the police officer gives usually his statement, and then the body cam comes out, and it is completely different than the statement is completely different than what the footage shows.
Right, but if the police officer can look at the body cam footage...
Right, can marry up the two versions.
And then what about, like, freedom of information laws, right? Can I file a freedom of information law and get the police department's, you know, body camera footage for X, Y, and Z? And also, you know, you go into, say, a police officer goes into a domestic violence situation, right? What do you do with that footage? How do you protect that? I mean, I think that, you know, body cameras, like many technologies, was rolled out as being a kind of panacea, right? Something that was going to really be a magic bullet and really help us deal with this really systematic problem of police violence, particularly against men of color. And it's not, right? It's a tool. Maybe it can be helpful in some respects. Most likely, it's not going to change the systemic dynamics. And I think that's true for many of the technologies that are touted these days.
You mentioned freedom of information. Are body cam footage, is it admissible in court? Do we know? John, do you know?
I don't know. I think that's a question FISA is better placed to answer than I am.
I mean, we've certainly seen it used in these various court cases, right? Which, you know, we've had a number of criminal, not a number of criminal trials, but we've had a number of instances where criminal charges were considered against police officers for acts of violence, use of force, rather. And very rarely have we seen either indictments, actually, and even less convictions.
Mm-hmm. And then what happens if an officer turns his or her body cam off during an arrest?
That's the question.
I mean, because I can't think of any kind of, like, on-the-books penalty for doing that.
So each police department has its own policies, right? We are a federalized system. There's no single policy. There's no single uniform standard that every police department has to follow. So it's going to vary police department by police department.
And, John, I'll give you the last word because we have to go. What do you hope will happen as a result of the piece that you've written for The Economist?
What I hope will happen is that people will look at the sort of legislation that has been proposed in California that would require police departments to be open about what they use, how they use it, how often they use it, and would compel them to submit to public approval any new tech that they want to buy. They would have to give the reasons for doing it. My hope is that people will learn about legislation like that and take steps to implement it where they live.
John Fassman is The Economist's Washington correspondent, and Faiza Patel is a co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program, both speaking about the promise and peril of technologically driven changes in the justice system. John Fassman's latest article is called Data Detectives. John, Faiza, thank you both very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.